ideological is the argument from design. Before you start, I was just thinking about it during the break, but just letting you know, Moreland, Craig, and Geisler, Habermas, other guys like that, those guys are like way above me, so if I disagree with them on one point, and I think I'm right and they're wrong, that's on that one point. The vast, you know, these guys, I'll refer to authors, and somebody like Craig will probably quote them in the original language the guy wrote, so, you know. So those guys are world-class thinkers, and I certainly don't claim to be, but I just think every once in a while as you study their works, you find something. They're fallible, everybody's fallible, and so I disagree with them on some stuff there. So now we're looking at the teleological argument. That's the argument from design and order in the universe. And there's three really different, the three main areas that Christian apologists go to for different types of evidence of intelligent design would be specified complexity, irreducible complexity, and the anthropic principle. Okay? Now, specifying complexity is that deals with the highly complex and well-ordered information found in all living things. Okay? It's not just complex, but it's also specified. Okay? So, you can take the 26 letters of the English alphabet and get 10 groups of those letters. Now you got 260 letters, and you can just throw it out. That's complex, but it's not specified until you start making specific words, sentences, and things of that sort. We used to think, with information theorists or scientists, we used to think, everybody else thought that the information scientists dealing with specified complexity, we used to think that they were giving us an analogy, that they are saying that the highly complex and well-ordered information found in all living things is like human languages, is like a language. And it took 10 or 20 years before everybody outside their field started figuring out, wait a minute, these guys are saying it is a language. Okay, it has all the things you need to have a language, it's got. Okay? And just an example of specified complexity, a single-celled animal. They used to, if you read apologetics books that are like 40 years old, they would tell you it contains enough genetic information to fill one volume of encyclopedia. They don't say that anymore. Now they say it contains enough genetic information to fill 20,000 volumes of encyclopedia. So the more we learn about the single cell, the more, and anybody, you can read what Bill Gates says about the subject. You can read what Richard Dawkins, the 20,000 volumes encyclopedia, that comes from one of Dawkins' quotes in one of his books. So this is, we're going into the enemy camp, and they're agreeing with us on this. Okay? So just as you would never get accidentally a Webster's Dictionary or one volume of encyclopedia through random explosions in a print shop, there's no way you're going to get 20,000 volumes of encyclopedia by chance. It takes that amount of highly complex and well-ordered specified information. It takes intelligent design. William Dempsey is the lead guy on that. He's got two PhD degrees. mathematics, I think from the University of Chicago. What's his other one? Is it microbiology? What's his other one?
I think philosophy.
Oh, that's right. Philosophy and mathematics. And really, he's a really humble guy, too. I've never met William Dembski, but I've met an awful lot of people who met him.
I went to his college and go.
Good deal. Yeah, he does a lot of teaching for Southern Evangelical Seminary in North Carolina. And so that's specified complexity, okay? That the design in all living things, it takes an intelligent designer. You can't get an increase in this information by chance. Natural laws, time plus chance don't produce it. Takes intelligent intervention. Geisler, to explain specified complexity, is the difference between looking at one cliff or one mountain, and you say, yeah, I can explain that through erosion and the laws of nature, and then looking at the faces of Mount Rushmore. Okay? It's like the faces of Mount Rushmore, that didn't come about by erosion. That was an intelligent design. Okay? My students are all Seahawks fans, and I'm a Raider fan. And so I tell them, what would you do if you came into my class and you saw that I was eating alphabet cereal? And I spilled some of the alphabet cereal, or I claimed I did. But you look next to my bowl of alphabet cereal and you saw Seahawks stink, Raiders rule. And then you get mad at me, you say, Doc, they call me doctors. Doc, that offends me. And I said, why are you offended? He said, because you wrote Seahawks stink, Raiders rule. And I tell him, I said, no, that wasn't me. I was just having a cereal, some of it spilled. It's not my fault that it spilled out in that order. You know, how convincing of an argument would that be? No, they know that I was lying through my teeth. And it was ordered. It was designed. Now, Seahawks fans would not take that as evidence of intelligence. but they would see design in there somewhere. But whatever the case, so that's specified complexity. And that's William Dembski is the kind of the lead go-to guy on that. And he's just a kid too. He's at least a few years younger than me, so that gives him the kid status. So he's going to be around for a while. Irreducible complexity. There is an assistant professor of microbiology at Lehigh University named Michael Behe. I wouldn't be surprised if he's becoming a full-blown born-again Christian, whatever that means, because he speaks at so many of our conferences. But he's a quiet, soft-spoken guy. He's a real scientist, not like Richard Dawkins, who makes his living talking about science. He actually does science and works in a lab and all. But he wrote the book Darwin's Black Box. And what he shows there is that in Darwin's day, they didn't know what existed on a submolecular level. So Darwin thought that complex things above the molecular level weren't really as complex as they looked. They were just a bunch of simple molecules thrown together. So it looks, even humans, we look complex, but it's just a bunch of simple molecules thrown together. But it was a black box in Darwin's day. By that, that's an expression that basically means nobody knows what's in that box. And so Darwin, to help out his theory of evolution, he was hoping for, and he assumed, so he taught that in that black box at submolecular levels, things are very simple there. But Michael Behe said, yeah, but Darwin was wrong. And we all know he was wrong. Because now we've looked into that black box. We took the lid off it. We got to the submolecular level, and we find entities on a submolecular level that are as complex as spaceship or computers, but they're irreducibly complex. You know, he brings up examples like the immune system, the blood clotting system, the bacterium flagellum, and he brings up all kinds of examples of this where there are things that work like computers or spaceships, but the problem is they're not only that complex, but they're irreducibly complex. So if you remove one part, or if one little part just didn't function properly, the whole thing would cease to function, the whole thing would cease to survive, and the whole thing couldn't evolve into something more complex than itself. And so he's basically saying there's no stages before it. These things had to be created exactly as they are, because they only function in this fully developed stage. And so he's caught all kinds of flack for that. I met him in North Carolina, and I wish I could say, I mean, I like the guy, because I like quiet people. He didn't say a word, he's just a quiet scientist. I mean, this guy had his lab glasses on with the kind of the lenses, the shields on the side, and he had his, this thing in his pocket with the pens out, and he looked like a scientist. He's just a quiet scientist who was a nominal Catholic. I don't know what he means by nominal Catholic. I don't know if he means like I show up for Mass on Sunday, or if he means I show up for Easter and Christmas. But I wouldn't be surprised if he's getting, more vibrant faith in Christ at this point, because he is attending a lot of conferences with other apologists. And so there's a big emphasis on Christ where he goes. But that's irreducible complexity. By the way, I should mention William Paley here. Craig will talk about him. But William Paley, so much more brilliant than he's given credit for. Everybody acts like David Hume refuted him, when in reality, his work actually refutes the ideas promoted by Hume. I don't even remember who came first. But whatever the case, he says, if you walked out into the wilderness and you found the rock, you just say, okay, well, that rock, I could explain how the rock got here, like erosion or whatever. But if you found the watch, even if you never saw a watch before, you would know, okay, this got here by intelligent design. This was designed. And then William Paley goes into the human eye. And I'm telling you, take what William Paley says about the human eye in, I think, the 1700s, and match that with what Richard Dawkins says about the human eye in the year 2012 or whatever. It makes you wonder if Dawkins even cares about keeping up with scientific research. But the human eye is not something that, I mean, just think about it. With all the parts, all the intricate parts that a human eye has, do we really believe that things were, you know, I was going to say walking into walls, but I guess there wouldn't be any walls there back then, but cave walls. But you really think things would be banging into trees and stuff with, you know, 97% formed eyes, you know, from 1%? Through the evolution, that's 5%, through, I mean, the thing can't see until all the pieces are put together and in the proper place. So William Paley's watchmaker argument, I think, still stands as the great illustration of the teleological argument. And that's Michael Behe, that's irreducible complexity. Then the anthropic principle, from the Greek word anthropos, for man. And what the anthropic principle is that when scientists looked at the planet Earth and our solar system, they started coming to the conclusion that it looked like The solar system was fine-tuned for the purpose of supporting human life on the planet Earth. And then when they looked at our galaxy, and then the entire universe, they started getting the impression that the entire universe was fine-tuned to support human life on the planet Earth. Okay? Now, Hugh Ross is probably the go-to guy to the old Earth creationist, his creator in the cosmos. He'll list like 40-something different parameters, precisely defined parameters that you would have, for life to exist on Earth in our solar system. They age about the same amount in the universe. I mean, you change the chemical composition of some elements, just 1 or 2% of far reaches of the universe, and there'd be no possibility of life on the planet Earth. Okay? And these scientists now, they're desperately, I'm telling you, the design argument is so strong that less and less of the world's leading evolutionary scientists are arguing in the Darwinian way that life evolved from non-life on planet Earth. Many of the world's leading evolutionary scientists have conceded the point that it's impossible for life to have evolved from non-life on the planet Earth. And so what they're doing now, they're jumping on the panspermia bandwagon. Watson and Crick did it. Dawkins hinted that he's moving in that direction, where they're basically saying that primitive life forms were brought to the planet Earth either purposely or by accident. Maybe they showed up on an asteroid. But primitive life evolved somewhere else in the universe. The chances of it evolving here on planet Earth are just too low. But that just shows that the intelligent design movement has actually won. Okay? And I already told you, I used to argue evolution needs God, but God doesn't need evolution. Now I've updated my argument to aliens need God, but God doesn't need aliens. Okay? But these guys are acting like, you know, if we just find a planet that's basically a sphere about the size of the planet Earth with a star that's basically the size and spherical like our sun, and the same approximate distance with the same approximate revolution and the same rotation there, that's all we gotta find. Okay, and by the way, there might not be that scenario. I don't know. In the entire universe. But even if you found that, you would still need a moon to control the tides, if you're gonna have human life on the planet Earth. You'd need a solar system very similar, if not identical to our solar system. You gotta have like a planet Jupiter, the size of Jupiter, with such a strong gravitational pull. You know, Jupiter's getting hit probably every Earth day or two with asteroids that would wipe out all life on the planet Earth. But it's no problem for Jupiter, and it gets pulled into that gravitational pull of Jupiter. But if Jupiter wasn't there, we'd be toast. And so it's quite possible that the whole solar system was designed the way it was to support life on the planet Earth, and the galaxy set up to support the solar system, and the rest of the universe to support the galaxy. And even when they do all their equations, it's called the Drake equation. Say, well, there's got to be life on other planets because you know, but they multiply it by one. It was a young Earth, I think it was Dr. D. D. Young, a young Earth creation scientist, that said that the number one that they use, they never tell you what it is, but they multiply it by one, and then that gives them the possibility, you know, how many planets would be out there. But the number one represents all the planets that we know of where life accidentally and randomly evolved from non-life. So in other words, they assume, at the start of their research, they assume that there's no God, and life evolved randomly here on the planet Earth, and then they apply it across the board. So they haven't even proven they're number one. I think their number one is a zero. So what does that do for Drake's equation? But whatever the case, the anthropic principle says that when you look, this is why even Richard Dawkins admits in the God delusion that the universe has the appearance of intelligent design. But then he explains why he thinks that's an illusion. Now that's a good scientist for you. It has the appearance. How do we get to the appearance of the universe? Through the five senses. Oh, that's through scientific study. So scientific study tells us the universe appears as if it was designed to support human life on the planet Earth, and then Dawkins calls that an illusion. And he acts like he's being scientific. No, he's rejecting what science is telling him. And he goes to multiverse theory and all that kind of weird stuff to try to avoid it. But scientists say, well, look, the universe appears as if it was fine-tuned or designed to support human life on the planet Earth. That's the anthropic principle. But we know it can't be that way. Why can't it be that way? Because that sounds too much like Genesis chapter 1. So what do? They move, and then they come up with their own anthropic principles. And so it'll take on, they'll title it something and use the initials plus these initials, and that'll be there. And so in other words, there's numerous anthropic principles, but in each one of these, what they're trying to do is explain away the anthropic principle. They're trying to say, well, it looks like the universe was fine-tuned to support life on planet Earth, but we know that we randomly got here, so that isn't the case. So here's how I'm explaining why it looks that way. And then Hugh Ross got so fed up, he says that you could take all these anthropic principles, and then he would call them the completely ridiculous anthropic principle. And so you spell out that acronym, and you see where Hugh Ross is coming from, what his assessment of that situation is. But if we just take what our senses are telling us, as we examine the universe, if the universe appears as if it was fine-tuned to support human life on the planet Earth, maybe it was. Who's the fine-tuner? Who's the intelligent designer? And that's dealing with the evidence rather than trying to explain it away. By the way, a lot of times what they're going to do is they're going to go to quantum physics, subatomic particle movement. And the reason why is because they don't know what in the world is going on at that level. Okay? And let me tell you, it's a bad hermeneutical principle when you're to interpret the Bible by taking isolated, vague passages that nobody knows what they mean, and then using them to interpret the clearer, more numerous passages. That's horrible hermeneutics. But that's not only a bad way to interpret the Bible, that's a bad way to interpret reality. We know a whole lot about what's going on above the subatomic level. So why in the world would we say, okay, it looks this way, but it really isn't? Because we're going to apply theories, speculation, from subatomic particle movement, and then use that to explain what's going on there. So they go into the unknown, to the mysteries, to explain what is known, and that's just not fair. You want to just sit down, Nate? That'd be great. This is my grandson, Nathan. And we just got done going to class at OC. So whatever the case, whether you look at big or you look at small, there's evidence of design. Whitaker Chambers, this is all on the congressional record, by the way. Whitaker Chambers, who's a buddy of Alger Hiss, the first Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations, And Whittaker Chambers was a card-carrying member of the Communist Party, wanted to overthrow America from within. He also stated under oath that Alger Hiss was as well. Alger Hiss ended up in prison because he perjured himself when he was being questioned on these issues. And but Whittaker Chambers' seven-year-old daughter had an earache. And he started examining her ear, and he saw how well-designed her ear was for the purpose of hearing, and all of a sudden it dawned on him, God exists. Now, Whittaker Chambers was a very consistent thinker, unlike most people today, most Americans today, and he realized that God exists, communism is not the best economic theory. It's a bad economic theory, and it treats humans like something less than beings that were created in God's image. And so he realized, I need to get out of the Communist Party. It took him 2 years to get the courage to get himself safely out of it, and then he testified before Congress and all. You can read about W. Cleon Skousen's work, The Naked Communist. But there's an example of guys looking in his daughter's ear, and he realizes God exists. When this guy in the back of the room, who's, you know, big enough to toss me like a rag doll, and, you know, deadlifts about 500 pounds, benches over 300 pounds, the day he was born, within minutes of his birth, it was my turn to hold him, and they handed him to me, they handed my grandson to me. If I wasn't atheist, I was an atheist, but if I was an atheist, at that point, I would have become a theist. I would have said, there's no way that this little boy got here by chance. So a newborn baby, you could look at the face of a newborn baby, you could look at a single-celled animal, you could look small, you could look big. But if you're looking close enough, you're going to see the hand of God. And so that's the argument from design. And you'll see, you know, King David said in Psalm 19:1, the heavens declare the glory of God, the skies proclaim the work of his hands. Paul talks about that we don't see the invisible God, but we see the visible work of his hands through his creation in Romans 1:18-23. So that's the argument from design. Now, let's look at the argument from reason. We'll skip the moral argument, go to the argument from reason. All right, the moral argument is going to take a little bit more time. But the argument from reason, C.S. Lewis, hold that page there where you see Richard Taylor's illustration. It's back here. But then go to the earlier pages, and I think I've got a little summary of C.S. Lewis's. No, I don't. All right. Well, C.S. Lewis, in his book Miracles, he just argues that, look, when he uses the word reason as a title for man's thinking ability. And even the atheist trusts his reason when he thinks his reason is telling him that God doesn't exist. But we all use our reason. But C.S. Lewis said, though, if our reason got here through non-rational causes, then we have no reason to trust what our reason is telling us. Okay? Richard Taylor, philosopher who gives an excellent illustration to prove this point, he says that, let's say this lady is on a train and she's trying to go to Wales, but she's never been there. Okay? And so she sees on the side of the hill white stones that spell out, welcome to Wales. Okay? Now, get the design argument out of your minds. We're not talking about that. So this isn't my alphabet cereal. You know, Seahawks State Raiders rule. It's not that illustration. Now this is welcome to Wales. That represents human reason. And she's free to believe that using human reason, human thinking ability, got here by chance. In other words, she's free to believe that the rocks randomly fell down the hill, the hillside, and arbitrarily, accidentally spelled out, welcome to Wales. So she's free to believe that reason, human reason, has non-rational causes and accidentally evolved, accidentally got it. She's free to believe that those rocks arbitrarily rolled down, accidentally rolled down the hill. But, since she's never been to Wales, if she believes those rocks accidentally spelt that, she has no reason to believe what the rocks are telling her. She has no reason to believe that she's actually entering Wales. See, the only way, since you look at those rocks that say, welcome to Wales, and really believe that she's entering Wales, is if that has a rational cause. If people purposely put welcome to Wales there. If it accidentally fell down, she'd look, she'd say, that's interesting and very coincidental, but I have no idea if I'm entering Wales, because I don't believe that God here through rational causes. The atheist is saying, I'm trusting my welcome to Wales. I'm trusting my reasoning ability. I'm trusting what my reason tells me. I'm trusting that message. But I don't really believe it's a message at all. Because I believe my reason, my thinking ability, got here by chance. Okay? So now, C.S. Lewis is not saying that what your reason is telling you is false if God exists. He's just saying that if God doesn't exist, and your thinking ability didn't get here by rational causes, he's just saying you have no way of knowing. So there's no reason for you to trust in your reason unless your reason came from a rational God. By the way, it was this argument, and I said, so the fact that we can reason is more reasonable to believe that we were created by a rational God in his image than it is to believe that our reason got here by non-rational causes. If we're going to trust our reason, and every time Alvin, my student from Sweden, the atheist student, tried to object, I said, yeah, but you're assuming the validity of human reason. Your worldview doesn't provide for that. You're borrowing capital from the Christian worldview. After three attempts, on his third attempt to say something, he stopped. He said, I'm assuming reason, the validity of human reason again, aren't I? And I said, yes, you are, Alvin. Then he was quiet for the rest of the class. Then after the class was over, everybody else left and said, you know, I was quiet in the class because I wasn't offended by anything that you said. I thought you were very fair to me. I said, no, I wasn't offended by anything you said either. He said, well, the reason why I just want to let you know, I wasn't angry with you. That's not why I was quiet. I just didn't know how to respond to this. And then his hero was Christopher Hitchens, the late Christopher Hitchens. And he asked if Christopher Hitchens ever wrote a refutation of it. I said, no, I think he just does what most atheists do. They just ignore it. And he said, well, can you let me know some books that talk about this argument? I'd like to dedicate my life to refuting it. And so I bought him, you know, C.S. Lewis's Miracles and a few other books, In Defense of Miracles by Doug Guyvid and Gary Habermas. And so he actually felt that this in the beginning of the universe were the two things he could not get his mind around. And but that's the argument from reason. Now the moral argument just says that. See by the way, that phrase. From Cornelius Van Til, he's a presuppositional apologist. I'm not a presuppositionalist myself. I'm more of a classical or traditional apologist. But I like this phrase where he talks about non-believers living on borrowed capital from the Christian worldview. What he's saying is, since the Christian worldview is the true worldview, it's the true description of the world, and it has everything we need to live our lives here, And so if you have a worldview that's not a Christian worldview, you're going to have to regularly borrow capital from the Christian worldview because your bank account is bankrupt. Okay? And so Francis Schaeffer would say the same thing, that is, you know, he would basically say something along the lines that the denial of the Christian God is not livable. You can't live consistently with that denial. And, you know, you can deny the existence of the creator of this universe, but you still have to live in his universe. There's no other universes in which to live. And so you can deny him. And so Van Til would say that arguing against God's existence is like arguing against the existence of air. Every time you attempt to argue against air, you're taken in air all the time to make the denial. And so it would be along the lines of St. Paul saying, in him we live and move and have our being. But the atheist has to do that, to borrow capital from the Christian worldview. So with morality, basically when you're looking at absolute moral laws, absolute universal moral laws are moral laws that apply to all people at all times and all places. Okay? By the way, I think there's a lot less than we Christians think. Because if you can get an exemption or an exception from one, then it didn't apply to all humans at all times and all places. I know loving God better than you got and loving your neighbor and yourself. I know those are the two mega absolutes. Those apply to all people at all times and all places. And some other moral commands are absolute as well, and they flow from that. But whatever the case, like God's command not to eat pork, well, that was temporary. It didn't apply to all people. It just applied to the Jews, and didn't apply in all places. But so what the moral argument says is that there are absolute universal moral laws that apply to all people at all times and all places. And the only way to explain their existence is by positing the existence of an absolute moral law giver. Okay? Now you're going to hear people saying, I don't believe in absolute moral laws. Okay? I'm a moral relativist. I believe each person decides what is right or wrong for himself or herself. Okay? I don't believe in moral laws above all people, above all societies, above any world consensus. I don't believe in that. But these people will say things like, there's no such thing as right and wrong. Therefore, you Christians are wrong for wanting to have your views taught in the public schools. Well, wait a minute. If there's no such thing as right and wrong, then we Christians are never wrong. Leave us alone. So, but you'll have people saying, I don't believe in absolute moral laws, but then they're protesting for gay rights, or animal rights, or woman's rights, or whatever it may be that they're protesting for, or a woman's right to have an abortion, or whatever it is. Well, wait a minute. If there's no right and wrong, there are no rights. There are no human rights. There are no animal rights. I mean, you're on one side there's no right and wrong, so there's nothing good to stand up for, so stop condemning my behavior. But then even that, I don't even have to step to the other side of the pulpit. There's a contradiction there. What's the contradiction there? We're saying there are no moral absolutes, so stop condemning my behavior.
Is that a moral absolute?
Yeah, you're acting like, wait, there is a moral absolute. Don't judge me. I already told you guys the debate between the rabbi and the gay rights activist. Did I tell you in this course? Might have been in a previous course. All right. This was not long after Yitzhak got saved in 81. This was in the 1980s. And I watch it in Washington State, a debate between a New York rabbi and a gay activist. And the gay activist was arguing for the right for homosexuals to teach in the public school system. And the gay activist asked the rabbi, why do you think it's wrong for homosexuals to teach in the public school system? And the rabbi said, because homosexuality is a sin. And the gay activist said, but you can't say that because you're making a moral value judgment. At that point, the rabbi held up his hands and smiled and moved his head back like he was conceding the point. And I was like, come on, rabbi, you gotta have more fight than that. What are you doing, you know? And then a few minutes went by, and then the rabbi read a letter to the editor of the New York Times or whatever it was, where a homosexual was saying, I not only want the right to teach in the New York public school system district, but I also want the right to have sexual encounters with any consenting male students. Now, when he said that, the gay activist said, but I disagree with that. And then the rabbi said, but why do you disagree with that? And he said, because it's wrong. And then the rabbi smiled and pointed at him and said, but you can't say that. You're making a moral value judgment. And so the whole thing that went on there was, you had two different worldviews. You had the rabbi, and you had the gay activist. And the gay activist was saying, the reason why you're messed up, rabbi, is because you draw a line.